We next have Jean to give her presentation on Jean Darling.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be back here, and I have my own private cheering section here. First, I have a couple of readings, one of which is quite long, but is essential for the story that I'll be telling later. The first reading is from the article Primitive Freedom in An Anthropologist at Work, Writings of Ruth Benedict. Some of you may be familiar with her. She was an anthropologist in the 30s and 40s and has somewhat dropped out of consciousness, I think. And I'm quoting parts of the article and interspersing it with summaries. In the 1890s, some of Tsarist Russia's political exiles in Siberia went native, joining the nomadic people who lived there and learning their ways. One of the most notable of these exiles was Vladimir Bogoras, whose careful account of life among the Chukchi of northeast Siberia is one of the great anthropological volumes, Benedict writes. He was fascinated by his rich, murderous, suiciding Chukchi. Even their routine exchanges of commodities were occasions for knifing. Their language had no word for trading. Realistically enough, they called it blood feuding. Knifing came closer home, too. Some killed their fathers, and brothers their brothers, and with impunity. A strong man was one who could abuse anyone, relative or stranger. And the strong man had his own way and was envied. The father's boast when a child was born was, "Ah, I have created a strong man for times to come, one who will take the property of all those living in the country around us." Nothing was clearer than that the Chukchi knew they were not free. Their word for it was doom. They were, they said, doomed to anger, doomed to death, doomed to receiving supernatural power. They spoke truly. Anger swept over them like a flood from outside themselves. They showed their teeth, they growled, they lost consciousness of what they were doing. Men and women, too, disappointed in sharing the tag end of a smoke, had killed to get hold of the pipe. And many more had ruined themselves financially because the trader had known they would stop at nothing, at no price, to obtain tobacco without delay. Sons, too, were doomed to anger against their fathers and fathers against their sons. If they killed in their anger, it was nobody's business, and the survivors divided the spoils. They chose to bring about their own death, too. When they suffered from despondency, which I can imagine was rather frequent, or from physical pain, they preferred, they said, to destroy the self with the suffering. "We are surrounded," they said, "by enemies with gaping mouths," the spirits. And the worst possible death was the torture these gods were waiting to visit upon them. They preferred to die at their own will. They would eat poisonous mushrooms, or stab themselves with a spear, or have their sons kill them. Benedict goes on. In such societies, men are intensely aware that every step toward any goal they have set themselves is at the mercy of others. They are balked at every turn, or else they win through by overpowering others. They know that whatever they want to do, they must get the better of someone else in the community, or they must play the sycophant. They know no other roles than those of aggression and of obsequiousness. Ruth Benedict contrasted these people with her own experience of the Blackfoot Indians of Canada, with whom she lived for a time. They too had been rich, and they had been democratic, which were both qualities of the Chukchi. But in addition, they were sure they had been free. Even today, they could not understand the meaning of being doomed. They were sure every man had his own personal desires and spent his life realizing them. What else would be a reason for living? They were full of tales of their great chief, Eagle in the Skies, chief of an illustrious Blackfoot band, and he was rich. All the Blackfoot cared about wealth, and they thought that people without wealth were inferior. Eagle in the Skies was a superior being, and he had wealth to prove it. He had been a great hunter and raider of horses. He could provide for a whole coterie of wives who dressed skins for him, made beaded garments, dried meat, and made pemmican. As the most successful provider in the band, he was made chief. But a chief among the Blackfoot was not invested with punitive power over his people, and his prestige depended on the band's prestige. His followers' personal ambitions were Eagle's greatest assets, and it was against his interest to balk them. A young retainer, as yet unmounted, had only to be known as a good horseman, to be free to use Eagle's horses in hunting or on a raid. What the young man took contributed to the glory and well-being of Eagle's band, but kudos belonged to the young hunter, even the kudos of distributing the horses or the buffalo meat. Mutual advantage flowed between the chief and his adherents. Eagle in the Skies served his own ends by seeing that his people could rise according to their abilities. Among such people, you were expected to take a major portion of what you killed or captured to your father-in-law, and in turn, your own sons would care for you when you were old. It was expected that people too old or sick to work would be cared for as they had once cared for others. Benedict writes, "Much of his behavior seems to us to put the interest of others above his own interests. But he would be completely incredulous if you tried to point this out to him. It appears to him that he has always done as he chose to do. Why else did he live?" Mary Mullen is going to read the other reading.
This is from a course description of Anthropology 345 at the University of Hawaii. Peace appears to be elusive, not because relatively nonviolent and peaceful societies are so rare, they are not, but instead because so rarely have nonviolence and peace been the focus of research in anthropology and other disciplines, including even the field of peace studies. The deficiency lies in the research, including the ethnographic record, and not in human nature. Although conflict is inevitable and ubiquitous, violence is not. Human nature has the psychobiological potential to be either nonviolent, peaceful, or violent, warlike. Nonviolence and peace appear to have prevailed in many prehistoric and pre-state societies. War is not a cultural universal. Potential for the development of a more nonviolent and peaceful world is latent in human nature, as revealed by the natural history of peace.
Thanks, Mary. Before I start in on the sermon itself, could we sing Shalom Havarim again with the words Shalom, instead of the ones printed in the program? Yeah, let's do it in round if you're able. That would be wonderful. Let's start with this side. So beautiful before I went to hear this. I first gave a version of this sermon at my home church in Oak Park in June. And I knew it would ruffle a few feathers talking about politics and religion in the same breath. So I very nearly threw in sex too, so it would have everything you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. But I know here at Prairie you like politics, so I feel a lot safer. On the other hand, I hear you're not so fond of religion. Today I want to talk to you about the public part of my vision of ministry. What I mean by political, what I mean by religious, and how they're related. This year has focused and intensified my interest, and with good reason, in nonviolence. It's been a hard year for everyone. We've just passed the one-year anniversary of September 11th. There's been a rise in military and other kinds of violence everywhere, and in the rhetoric of fear and hatred, the cynical copying of anti-terrorist language by despots around the world desiring to crack down on dissident and revolutionary thorns in their sides. It looks very likely that Congress will vote to give broad powers to the president to wage war against Iraq. September 11th made a lot of people realize that we were vulnerable, that bad things could happen to us here in the U.S. as well as overseas. We're discovering now, as information comes out, that we didn't respond adequately after the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Africa, or even after the first bomb was set off in the World Trade Center in the parking garage. We ignored bin Laden's threatening remarks way back then. We've learned that our various government agencies failed to communicate important information to one another that might have prevented the events of September 11th. This evidence appears to be more and more damning, but we don't really want to believe that their inaction was deliberate. This spring, my congressman, Danny Davis, addressed a town meeting at the Oak Park Village Hall, and he was asked if he supported the military policies President Bush was following. Before I tell you what he said, let me give you a little geographical information. Davis's district runs right across the middle of Chicago through Oak Park, where I live, and into the western suburbs. Evanston is up to the north of Chicago, and 95th Street is on the south side. About this question of war, Davis replied, "I'm not a believer in utopia. But I do believe if you want to get to the South Side, you need to turn your face to the South. Then every step you take will carry you closer. If you start by facing Evanston, you're never going to get to 95th Street." I love his analogy. If we want peace, let us not wage war. That's facing Milwaukee when we want to get to Middleton. Meanwhile, wars continue around the globe, mostly interior to countries, between a government and a rebel group. And millions of people, refugees from those wars, flood into more stable or wealthier countries, seeking safety and arousing fear, anger, and xenophobia, and sometimes racist responses from their new hosts. As of January 2001, there were 40 armed conflicts in 35 countries, mostly in Africa and Asia. Indonesia alone had 5 separate wars, which may still be going on, I haven't looked, where at least 1,000 people have died. A 1/6 of those wars was finally settled with independence in East Timor. Meanwhile, the U.S. has become the largest supplier of arms to the world. The good news is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, the total arms provided to developing nations has dropped by nearly half, from $40 billion in 1990 to about $23 billion in 99, in constant $99. In that same time, the U.S. share climbed from about $5 billion, or 1/8 of the total, to around $11 billion, or nearly half. Much of our foreign aid comes back to the U.S. companies in the form of such purchases. The grandstanding of Pakistan and India over Kashmir had us all quaking in our collective boots, knowing that the use of nuclear weapons by either side would harm people all over the world. War has always been considered a scourge of humankind, but our power to destroy ourselves through technology has outstripped even our imagination. Kant warned, well over a century ago, that wars would grow increasingly violent, and peace burdened by hostile policies that would lead to further conflict, ending in a final war of extermination. He wasn't an optimist, I guess. Such a war of extermination, he wrote, in which both parties and justice itself might all be simultaneously annihilated, would allow perpetual peace only on the vast graveyard of the human race. We just ended the bloodiest century ever. Why have we seemingly made so little progress? In my survey of nonviolence this year, I've run across several projects that give me hope. First, it seems we have spent so much time studying violence and war that we neglected to study peace. Many people believe that war is inevitable, that violence is somehow hardwired into the human brain. But anthropologists have found societies that do not know war, that do not use violence to solve their problems. As one anthropologist put it, conflict is inevitable. Violence is not. I've sometimes wondered if we confuse we, the people that I hang out with, middle class, UUs, if we confuse conflict with violence, and this, it may be an attitude that's spread throughout our society. If we confuse conflict with violence, we fear conflict because to us it means violence. If this is not true for you, then you have a healthy attitude toward conflict, and you don't have any problems dealing with it. Congratulations. Is there anyone here like that? In the piece of American culture I grew up in, violence or its cousin, coercion, was just around the corner. Conflict would lead to some kind of coercive result, with the threat of violence visible as rage in the person if you continued to oppose them. I believe ours is a violent society, But the violence is not always visible to those of us living middle-class lives. One hears repeated stories of violence, and you hear this in Chicago at least, stories of violence done to African Americans by the police without provocation, though the stories that make the news are of middle or upper middle class blacks harassed, sometimes even shot and killed by police. But for ordinary black folks, such treatment is part of the fabric of their existence in America. A woman I met recently has been involved with a group of Chicago citizens seeking to have police officer Thomas Burge removed from duty and face criminal charges for torturing confessions from prisoners. Her son was one such person. She believes her son innocent of the murder he was charged with. He is serving a life sentence. He's not on death row. She told me that once the police knew her as an agitator and anti-police violence protester, they began to pursue and harass her other adult children. They had to leave Chicago to get relief. This is not the kind of treatment that we here in this room would expect from the police, nor for the most part do we know anyone who has experienced this. Reverend James Lawson helped develop the nonviolent strategy of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and he was working with the sanitation workers in Memphis when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. He's still active and spoke eloquently to an interfaith group in Chicago that I was at last year of nonviolence and especially of nonviolent direct action, a technique that brings the principle of freedom face-to-face with oppression. One famous example is the Voting Rights March in Selma, when the marchers were told to turn back. They should not try to cross the bridge. They chose to act in freedom and to let the world witness the sheriff's violent response. The sheriff had only two choices: to allow them to cross or try to prevent it. Reverend Lawson told us, "Nonviolent direct action challenges our violent society. It undermines that violence with an alternative way of being." There's a rather shocking little zine called Race Traitor, which is full of stories of young people, white, who identify with blacks and who refuse to accept what they see as white privilege. They notice when a black person has been stopped by the police and they go stand nearby to witness, to, by their presence, perhaps prevent mistreatment. This is nonviolent direct action too, and a reason for hope. In all the various activist groups I'm familiar with, from environmentalism to economic globalization, from peace to neighborhood issues, there's a growing commitment to nonviolent principles. I find hope, too, in the growing numbers of programs in the schools teaching even quite young children how to mediate, how to deal with conflict with other children in their schools. And another technique, less formal, simpler than conflict resolution, is called nonviolent communication. Psychologist Marshall Rosenberg developed this technique over years of dealing with people's fights in therapy and his own responses. It's easy to learn how to do it and extremely difficult to do. And here's the quick outline. You practice paying attention to your own feelings and needs, and then you practice paying attention to the other person's feelings and needs. In your speech, you avoid judgment. You avoid reward or punishment or inflicting guilt shame or a sense of duty on the other person. Try not to do those. You try to keep in mind all the while, and this is perhaps how you do it, what can I do to make life more wonderful for me and for the other person? Rosenberg is full of stories of how doing these few things has changed a tense, even dangerous situation into one where people have found kinship and mutual regard. You can take a class in this. I don't know about Madison, but the people in Chicago, if you don't have someone here who's trained, the people in Chicago would probably be willing to travel. You can join a discussion group and practice this kind of communication. And there were like 300 people at an introductory talk in Oak Park about nonviolent communication. And for me, this is a powerful, another thread of hope. Rosenberg mentions anthropologists such as Ruth Benedict, whose work I read from, and O.J. Harvey, whose studies showed that use of judging language correlate with violence in a society. If you believe that someone has done you wrong, that they are at fault, then you can justify retaliating. And here is where all this theorizing begins to intersect with politics. What kind of a world do we want to live in? Certainly, I don't want to live in a world like the Chukchi, young men dominated by their tyrannical fathers, jeered at, belittled by their families and their in-laws until they themselves can arrive at the position of tyrant. So interesting to me. They felt so helpless to behave otherwise, so doomed to anger, doomed to death. It reminds me of the sense of helplessness I've read about in people who commit violent acts in this country, such as people who batter their partners. No, I would rather live in a world like that of the Blackfoot chief, Eagle in the Skies, where people felt free, even though they obeyed rather strict cultural expectations about supporting their in-laws, the elderly or the sick, where gift-giving was a natural part of life, where young men had a chance to prove themselves and bring glory to the whole tribe by using their elders' horses to conduct a raid or hunt. Ruth Benedict writes, in reflecting on these two societies, "Those societies where men know they are free are often democracies, but sometimes they have strong chiefs and kings. Whether they are democracies or kingdoms, they have, however, one common characteristic. They are all alike in making certain freedoms common to all citizens and inalienable." We believe in freedom, then we must defend it. We must use our democratic political system to make our views known and keep the laws in sync with our sense of fairness and equal treatment for all. Oops. I just used the must word, which Marshall Rosenberg says can arouse a sense of guilt or anger or obligation by duty, which is contrary to the ideas of nonviolent communication. So let me put it another way. I believe in freedom, in the kind of freedom the Blackfoot possess, a freedom based on loving commitment to the group, on interdependence. I believe in the freedom that comes with our society making certain freedoms available to everyone and inalienable. I believe that some of the legislation enacted and actions taken by our government since September 11th are undermining that freedom by legitimizing unequal treatment of people in this country. If we want peace, writes philosopher Cecilia Bach, we need to learn to abandon violence, lying, betrayal, and excessive secrecy on both the personal and the government level. Violence, lying, betrayal, and excessive secrecy. Look at some of the federal policies being enacted now and over the past year. Violence, not flowers, emerges from the mouth of our gun, Afghanistan, a war that took place that continues with almost no media coverage. The new policy of preemptive attacks to justify the push to attack Iraq. The U.S. self-righteously accuses Saddam Hussein, yes, a thug, a violent and unscrupulous man, of using chemical warfare against his own people, the Kurds. And yet, I read, we provided him with the coordinates he needed to launch those attacks. Lying. Earlier this year, the administration tried to justify providing disinformation not only to our enemies or to the people in Europe, but to the American public. The proposal was met with such an outcry that either it has been abandoned, as I hope, or it has been moved underground. Betrayal. Over the past few years alone, we have seen examples of our government suddenly turning about and ousting a dictator who was once one of our close friends. I don't mind that they dumped Noriega, one example. But even in our dealings with Iraq, we have said one thing and done another. We as much as gave Hussein a green light to invade Kuwait, and then attacked him when he did. Toward the end of the Gulf War, we urged the Iraqi people to rise up against him and then stood by watching as their troops were destroyed. I mean, our own troops could see it happening and were not allowed to go help them. Has it not been a kind of betrayal of the American people for this administration to abrogate long-standing treaties such as the ABM Treaty unilaterally, to withdraw from long-established and accepted international rules of law like the Geneva Accords, the rules of war, and secrecy? The administration has used the threat of terrorism to justify heightened secrecy even for completely unrelated issues such as discussions between the administration and corporations on energy policy and on the Enron scandal. That threat also justifies abandonment of normal due process for those accused in connection with terrorism. Keeping secret the judicial process of accused Muslims, some of whom have been arrested and held incommunicado for minor visa violations. Our government is violating all the rules for creating real peace, according to Bach. I've heard it said both ways lately. You can't fight fire with fire. And sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. You have to laugh sometimes at the human capacity for justifying whichever position one desires. At least I try to laugh. Perhaps you saw in the news the other day about a new archaeological find in Central America, steps carved with hieroglyphics that detail the downfall of the Mayan Empire. A feud, an unending war between brothers, rival kings, fighting for domination that led to blood flowing like water, skulls stacking up like pumpkins. I feel that when we rely on violence to solve our problems, we are marching down that same path. To my amazement, even Bush likes to compare us to the Roman Empire, apparently forgetting what happened to that superpower in its own time. Perhaps the most difficult task for people of faith, people of conviction, is to not yield to the temptation to demonize the other. Even as I preach about the need to distinguish between a life of unconscious hatred and one of conscious freedom and generosity, I run the risk myself of speaking in dualisms that lets us put ourselves into an us and them paradigm. Jay Deacon, the former minister in Oak Park, wrote about the political process, that when we involve ourselves in it, we must always remember it as a lover's quarrel. A lover's quarrel. We're all brothers and sisters. We cannot imagine we cannot let ourselves imagine that we can stamp out any idea or attitude or movement or group of people. To believe that we can triumph over others leads to the kind of thinking that currently rules our government. No amount of arguing will change someone's mind. I'm sure you've had that experience, going one way or the other. Who do we listen to? We listen to someone we trust, who has listened to and heard us. To listen empathetically is one of the most difficult things in the world, especially if we ourselves have strong feelings about a subject or a situation. How difficult to listen to someone we disagree with long enough for them to feel heard, so that our own feelings can be heard in return. This is part of nonviolent communication, as Marshall Rosenberg teaches it. My religion is our UU community. It is our principles. It is our history. And it is the small voice of my own conscience. All of these things join in committing me to the path of nonviolence. My religion supports our democratic tradition, and it tells me that life here on earth is what counts. When I say it is good to participate in the political process as religious people, I do not mean as holy warriors, our swords of righteousness held aloft, but instead bringing to it this commitment as a work of love, a lover's quarrel, bringing to it a continual awareness of one another as interrelated, bringing a vision of freedom that includes our mutual responsibility and caring for one another. Politics is a messy tug of war of differing visions of how we should live our lives. We can embrace its rough and tumble as part of life, as one piece of conflict, if we feel free and don't allow ourselves to be silenced by our fear. I've seen people who lived in much more violent societies than ours, Brazil for one, under an oppressive military dictatorship in the 70s, who came out the other side fearlessly. They still had to be cautious, but they weren't frightened. In Poland, people chose to act as if they were free, and their fearlessness helped to topple the dictatorship and bring about democratic reforms. Through the Unitarian stream of our religion runs a commitment to freedom, to reason, to tolerance. Through the Universalist stream, a commitment to compassion and equality. These mighty forces can carry us along, and with their strength and our willing pull, we can help to bring society closer into balance with the vision of the society we'd rather live in. A society of generosity, of abundance, of freedom, not just for ourselves, but for everyone. May we have a moment of silence. Now, I understand that you like to have some discussion right in the middle of the service.
Oh, no, not for the service. Yeah, I probably guess it's somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Somewhere in the service. So now we'll open it up to questions and discussions.
And let me preface it by saying I'm a minister. I'm not an expert. And there are undoubtedly those of you here who know more about what I was talking about this morning than I do. And what I enjoy most about discussion is not me providing answers so much as what questions we can raise and work out among ourselves. So,
shall I call people?
Sure, yeah. Why don't you? Yeah, I agree. My sense is that unlike the Chukchi, our government is operating out of the Chukchi facade is there, but they're operating on a whole other level, and that's economic. That the real reason that we're doing this is because of the oil. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether there's any way to know that. I do believe that Bush is an extremely unconscious person. I think that there's an awful lot of stuff operating out of his unconscious. So, anyway, what about other... I think there's a whole lot of factors that go into that. There's a greater and greater monopolization of media. I mean, I think there's like five or six giant corporations that run almost all the media right now. Where are people going to get the information they need? I think we do have this is my personal belief, that we are not a very conscious society. I think that we do have a tendency to, sort of fly by the seat of our pants, whatever. But that we do not, we have not developed that part of ourselves in general very much, so that we can step back and not be moved and manipulated by people like George Bush and his people. That's right, and I think that's what we need to be doing. Yeah, and I hear that they throw emails away now. I don't know why. Too much of it is what I don't know. But let me say that one of the symbols of freedom is to not let yourself feel doomed. So if you get that, if you start feeling that way, fight it. Do something. Yeah, and to me, it's a matter of whether you are raised. Some of it is just being taught certain habits, but I think also it has to do with being raised for consciousness. And the more conscious you can be, the more stuff you can raise up out of the unconscious, the better off we're going to be. That's my sense. To me, that's a piece of this nonviolent communication. You don't argue with someone. It doesn't do any good. As you say, it's not going to change their mind. What you do is, in this case, you listen to their fears about their children. Well, I think we need both. We have to act both politically, that's what I mean. We have to go out there and have an effect in the world, but we also have to be doing this stuff. I'm using violent language here. It's really important to try to apply this nonviolent communication in your everyday life, as well as take action in the world. You have to do both.
Thank you, Jane.
Good.
Now we'll have closing words from Jane.
These are words of Daniel Berrigan, launching from Psalm 126. When the Spirit struck us free, we could scarcely believe it for very joy. We were free, we were wrapped in a dream of freedom. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with pure joy. The oppressors were awestruck. What marvels the Lord works for them. Like a torrent in flood, our people streamed out. Locks, bars, gulags, ghettos, cages, cuffs, a nightmare scattered. We trod the long furrow, slaves, sowing in tears. A lightning bolt loosed us. We tread the long furrow, half drunk with joy, staggering. The golden sheaves in our arms. Go in peace.